Coming up on Fronteras, last month, a 31-year-old Oregon man died when his kayak capsized on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. The last 10 fatalities on the Colorado River and Grand Canyon have been on self-guided trips. More than 7,000 people opt to go without a guide each year.
Because it is one of the last places where you can have a true adventure. You are allowed to go down there and push your limits, and there aren't guardrails everywhere.
The risks some take and the river hazards also. In Phoenix, there's a unique tradition of bringing together both Jews and Latinos to celebrate Passover together.
Latinos are the fastest growing demographic in the United States, and relationships begin by breaking bread together and getting to know each other.
We hear about that Seder that brings together two ethnic communities, but first the news. Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Congress held a field hearing in Kingman this week for forgotten downwinders, people suffering from cancer caused by the fallout of atomic testing near Las Vegas in the 1950s. Legislation that passed more than two decades ago provided compensation for many people in the region, but left out Arizona's Mojave County and Nevada's Clark County, Laurel Morales reports.
From 1952 to 1962, the federal government detonated 86 atomic bombs near Las Vegas. Danielle Stevens was growing up on her family's cattle ranch in Kingman at the time.
Every time they announced it, we try to get someplace where we could see it, because my mom would say, "Oh, that she's so pretty, it looks like the Aurora Borealis." And we rode our horses, we rode up on the hill so we could see.
As a teenager, Stevens remembers shielding her eyes from the dusty wind after the explosions.
There's no doubt about it, what happened to the people. My husband and I together have 31 members that passed away from cancer.
And Stevens wasn't the only one at the hearing with a story like this. Mojave County Constable Jean Bishop says her mother told her the family would watch the nuclear weapons tests from their front porch.
She said she would hold me in her arms as an infant. We'd watch the clouds, and all the other five siblings would be around the front porch area, and we would just kind of enjoy it. It didn't have a lot of television back then, so we felt it was entertainment.
Bishop recently completed breast cancer treatment, and her husband is also a cancer survivor. She suspects the radiation exposure caused their cancers. She was born in Clark County near Las Vegas and has lived the rest of her life across state lines in Mojave. Those are the two counties that don't qualify for federal compensation, even though their cancer rates are higher than neighboring counties that do qualify. Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar is trying to change that.
You know, one side of the street was in, one side of the street was out. And when you clearly look at the scientific facts, both should be included. You know, justice should be blind. It should be equal in its application. And that's exactly what we're going to try to do here.
Gosar says Mojave and Clark counties were exposed to the highest levels of radioactive fallout. So why were these counties left out of the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act of 1990? Gosar says it was just politics, and no one really knows why. He held the field hearing because he wants to extend the legislation to include the forgotten counties. Downwinder Sherry Hanna testified at the hearing. She grew up in northern Arizona in a neighboring county. Her father died in 1983 of esophageal cancer. When Hanna and her sister discovered they were downwinders, they were shocked.
It's just really been like a nightmare. When we first learned of the program through my father, we couldn't believe that something like that could be associated with his sickness. And then when my husband was diagnosed, it was just, again, a devastating blow.
Her husband died last year from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, one of the many diseases that has been linked to radiation exposure. So she applied for compensation and received $50,000.
It was a big help in fighting the disease. You give it all back for what our insurance didn't cover and for travel expenses and everything. So it has helped, but it's very financially devastating.
Hanna says she's still dealing with $156,000 in medical bills. She says it takes a long time to receive a government check. Gosar says it may take an overhaul of the entire law, but he's not wasting any time. The window to file claims closes in 2022. I'm Laurel Morales in Kingman.
For the Jewish holiday Passover, families gather for the traditional Seder meal to commemorate the Jewish people's escape from slavery in Egypt. As Jude Joffe Block reports from the Fronteras desk, a unique tradition in Phoenix uses the holiday to bring together two ethnic communities.
One ritual of every Passover Seder includes asking the four questions. Here's Rabbi Dean Shapiro translating the first one from Hebrew.
Why is this night different from all other nights?
You could also ask, why is this Seder different from all other Seders? It's not just that it came a few days early. Every year for the past decade, it's brought together close to 100 people, some from Phoenix's Jewish community and some from the Latino community, and a handful who identify as both, like event organizer Carlos Galindo Elvira.
It's about building alliances, building relationships, building a future together. And it all starts with a very simple thing, talking with each other. And four cups of wine.
Four cups of wine are part of every Seder meal, and they do make it easier to make new friends.
Latinos are the fastest growing demographic in the United States.
Rabbi Maynard Bell helped found this event, known as the Latino Jewish Seder, a decade ago when he was with the American Jewish Committee. It's an advocacy group that has supported comprehensive immigration reform.
Relationships begin by breaking bread together and getting to know each other.
Or in this case, breaking matzah together. During the 8 nights of Passover, leavened bread isn't allowed. That prompted one person to question whether the ban includes corn tortillas. Turns out it depends which Jewish tradition you follow. Rabbi Dean Shapiro led the service, which retells the story of how Jews overcame being enslaved in Egypt and then wandered in the desert. He highlighted the themes that might resonate with both communities.
Join me, please. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the feelings of the stranger, having yourselves been strangers in the land of Egypt. So I wonder, when have you felt like a stranger? Like a fish out of water, like a foreigner. When have you felt not welcome?
First-time Seder goer Ale Urias told her table mates her answer.
So it takes me back to my childhood on having to go to a new school, and not only did I not understand English so well, you know, I'm Hispanic, I just felt kind of out of it.
I was one of that group that, when I was about 10 years old, started going to Hebrew school.
Larry Goodman was one of the Jews at the table.
There would be kids waiting for us and throwing snowballs at us, sometimes with rocks in the middle of the snowball.
The idea of bringing together Latinos and Jews for Passover in particular made sense to Vic Diaz.
It's impossible to listen to the story of Passover and not think about immigration today.
Like many here, Diaz is a member of the Hispanic Leadership Institute put on by local group Valle del Sol. He's also advocated for immigration reform.
We found great allies with our Jewish brothers and sisters in the past, and we still do today. So it's a beautiful symbolic event to just have us all here in the same room celebrating this together.
Is that your first matzo ball?
It is. Oh my gosh, it's delicious.
That's first-timer Ale Urias again.
I thought it was going to be plain, but oh my gosh, it's so rich in flavor. I love it. I might have another one.
Passover goes through April 22nd. In Phoenix, I'm Jude Joffe Block.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. The last 10 fatalities on the Colorado River and Grand Canyon have been on self-guided trips. We hear about the risks people take for true adventure.
You are allowed to go down there and push your limits. And there aren't guardrails everywhere. And there's not someone telling you you can't do it. You have to actually think and, you know, make conscious decisions about your actions.
Fronteras will be back after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. A new analysis of violence in Mexico finds that homicides appear to have dropped by about 15% last year compared to 2012. Fronteras reporter Jill Replicle has more.
There's good news and bad news in the latest report on drug violence from the University of San Diego's Justice in Mexico project. Homicides across Mexico appear to be on the decline from their high point in 2011. Mexican authorities would like to take credit for that decrease, but David Shirk, one of the report's authors, says that's debatable.
In some areas, for example, Baja California, Chihuahua, states along the border, certain cartels have essentially established a monopoly, so they don't need to fight anyone. They can get back to business.
Shirk says Mexico's crackdown on drug cartels may actually have contributed to the grisly violence there in recent years.
So now what you have in lots of places in Mexico are small bands and gangs of organized crime members who are no longer able to move cocaine from Colombia, but they can kidnap and they can extort people. And that's actually, in some ways, a worse problem for ordinary Mexicans.
Kidnapping and extortion have continued to rise in Mexico, even as organized crime killings have fallen. Plus, homicides in Tijuana increased last year by about 54% by one official count. Note, homicide figures in Mexico vary widely depending on who's counting. Authorities say most of those victims were involved in street-level drug trafficking. Despite the uptick, the number of homicides in Baja California last year was still less than half what it was in 2007 at the height of drug war violence there. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
While Congress is showing no signs of moving forward on passing comprehensive immigration reform, the complicated issue was spotlighted Tuesday night in a heated debate in Texas. As Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports, Texas Senator Dan Patrick and San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro publicly sparred over the issue that could decide the future of both of their parties.
Patrick and Castro aren't running against each other for political office. Castro, a Democrat, isn't running for anything right now. Patrick is running for what many call the most powerful job in Texas, lieutenant governor, and he's doing it with ads like this.
Dan Patrick is the only candidate for lieutenant governor to oppose in-state tuition for illegal immigrants.
I'll do what Washington won't do. I'll secure our border and I'll end sanctuary cities. And I'll never stop fighting against Obama's attacks on Texas.
Secure the border. Fight Obama. Dan Patrick for lieutenant governor.
Patrick was the top vote-getter in the March primary for the GOP nomination for lieutenant governor, but he still faces incumbent David Dewhurst in the May runoff. Castro said watching Patrick's political ads is what spurred him to send a tweet challenging him on the issue of illegal immigration.
You sent out the first tweet.
By the way, I'm glad to have boosted your followers.
That's good. Yeah. You did.
And that tweet led to Tuesday night's debate. And while Patrick and Castro shared a stage, they definitely did not share a common view on the future of Texas in regards to how to treat people who are in the state illegally.
You have talked about undocumented immigrants bringing third world diseases, including leprosy and polio, to Texas. You have said that we're seeing an illegal invasion from Mexico.
The fact is, I have to put American citizens, whether they be Mexican-Americans or Anglos or African-Americans or Asian-Americans, first.
In post-debate interviews, they disagreed on who won the debate. Castro said he was clearly the victor.
He couldn't defend his record tonight. He started talking again, defending his comments about third-world diseases coming into this country from immigrants. And he talked about the number of anchor babies.
And certainly, Patrick had a different tact.
You know, it wasn't about winning and losing. It was about communicating a message. I'll let the people decide that. It wasn't about winning and losing. We're not running against each other. We weren't trying to get voters.
University of Texas at San Antonio political science professor Walt Wilson says they each won because Patrick and Castro had different reasons for agreeing to the debate.
I would say it was in some ways a draw. Castro attempted to put Dan Patrick on the spot quite a bit. Patrick did a pretty good job of trying to change the subject to issues that he thought might help him score some points, like abortion and so on. So it was kind of an interesting exercise, given that they're not running against one another.
Clearly, both politicians are aware of the changing demographics of Texas and that a growing Latino population could mean the end of a solid GOP rule, particularly if the Texas Republican Party continues to embrace policies unpopular with the majority of Hispanics in the state. And Wilson says that was made clear in the debate during this exchange.
I'm the one candidate that the Democrats fear, and that's why all of you have been attacking me, because you know that I'm going to go out and speak to, like I am tonight, I have the courage to come and talk about public policy.
Actually, you're our meal ticket back in.
Yeah.
That is definitely telling as to why Castro thought that this debate might be worthwhile, which is that with Dan Patrick as the standard bearer for the Republican Party, you know, in the lieutenant governor's race, if he can be successfully painted as out of the mainstream, he can also be someone who begins to make it harder and harder for moderates to vote Republican.
And Wilson said Patrick's performance helped his chances in winning the lieutenant governor's runoff, but looking at the long-term, big picture in Texas politics, he may be hurting the Republican Party's chances in winning that critical Latino vote in future election cycles, maybe one where Patrick and Castro are running for the same office. In San Antonio, David Martin Davies reporting.
Last month, a 31-year-old Oregon man died when his kayak capsized on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. He was one of about 7,000 river runners who each year opt to go without a guide. The last 10 river fatalities in the Grand Canyon were on self-supported trips. From the Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales looks at the risks people take.
Many consider the Grand Canyon to be the premier whitewater rafting experience on the planet. It offers remote wilderness and spectacular beauty. About 25,000 people mark it off their bucket list each year. Veteran boatman Scott Davis outfits many of the private trips with equipment and food.
You put 25,000 plus into a 300-mile corridor that is filled with rapids and great side canyons and waterfalls, you know, you're gonna have some people injured.
The National Park Service requires a self-guided group to have a working knowledge of whitewater safety, navigation, and first aid. And one boater on the trip must have run the Colorado or similar river at least once before. So Davis says experience levels vary.
Even if you have 5 out of 15 that are really experienced, that's not saying that those 5 can always watch, you know, the other 10.
Davis says oftentimes someone has a heart condition or substance abuse is involved, or sometimes it's just a chain reaction of bad decisions.
It's just kind of what us humans do.
Davis's wife, Rachel Schmidt, also a longtime boater, says she's glad there aren't too many regulations.
Because it is one of the last places where you can have a true adventure. You are allowed to go down there and push your limits, and there aren't guardrails everywhere, and there's not someone telling you you can't do it. You have to actually think and, you know, make conscious decisions about your actions.
Boatman and Dr. Tom Myers co-wrote Death in Grand Canyon. He says it's not so much what private boaters lack, but what commercial guides possess.
They know the subtleties of how the river changes based on flows, like where particular hazards may show up, or a feature changes based on that flow and how best to avoid it.
That's why about 17,000 people pay commercial outfitters to take them through the canyon each year. In 2005, Dottie LaRue and her family took a guided trip. On the night she fell into the river, she was glad she did. LaRue and her rescuer, boatman Adam Bringhurst, recently reunited at her home in Cornville.
And Adam, hi. God, it's been a while.
Yeah, it has. How are you?
Bringhurst, at 6'3", towers over LaRue. At 87, she still hikes every day. She and Bringhurst recall what happened on the night when Dottie left her tent to go to the bathroom.
I was walking very carefully and putting my stick down in the water, and all of a sudden my stick didn't hit bottom. And then I knew I was in trouble.
LaRue's family heard her cry for help. They woke the whole camp, including Bringhurst, who grabbed his life jacket and headlamp and ran downstream. He saw Dottie's light bobbing in the river and jumped in.
He yelled at me, you know, that he was coming.
Bringhurst swam after LaRue for about a mile downstream.
when you hit the eddy and spun around backwards, I thought you had gone under. And that's when my heart sank. I stopped swimming. It was awful. I felt horrible. And then your light came back on. I came swimming up to you and I said, Dottie, what are you doing in the river? And you said, oh, Adam, I'm so glad to see you. And you were calm as could be.
Everybody did the right thing. That crew was well trained, knew what they were doing, and they took good care of me.
Bringhurst says it doesn't always work out so smoothly.
I've worked with river guides who are knuckleheads in their own way. I'm sure I've done stupid things as well. I've also seen private trips that are made up of boatmen who've been on the river for 30-plus years and probably doing it better than any of us.
He says if he was less experienced, he probably wouldn't have jumped in after Dottie. I'm Laura Morales in Flagstaff.
Also in Flagstaff, police and partner agencies are investigating several recent human-caused wildfires. A dry winter and more people who are homeless heading to the forests have emergency crews beefing up patrols. From Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
During warm weather months, Flagstaff's largest homeless shelter closes down at night. That means dozens of displaced people heading to the forests. Flagstaff bans camping within city limits, but the city is surrounded by 1.8 million acres of national forest. Only 15 prevention officers and lookouts staff that area. Coconino National Forest's Don Muse oversees them.
We're concerned, certainly, that a fire gets started in a bad spot and will carry and move fast beyond the capability of us getting out ahead of it and stopping it quickly.
Muse says wind is a critical factor this time of year. Four northern Arizona forests will begin enforcing fire restrictions about a month early to prevent wildfires. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations all along the Southwest. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.